Welcome to a very special edition of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Today, we had the pleasure of speaking with Jane L. Mizell, MD, an assistant professor in the Department of Hematology and Medical Oncology and Department of Gynecology and Obstetrics at Winship Cancer Institute of Emory University School of Medicine, and Erica P. Hamilton, MD, director of the Breast Cancer and Gynecologic Research Program and principal investigator at Sarah Cannon Research Institute, to discuss clinical cases in early-stage breast cancer. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Mizell and Dr. Hamilton provided insight on key data from the 2020 ASCO Virtual Scientific Program and best practices in managing patients during the coronavirus disease 2019 pandemic. So, Dr. Mizell, I will leave it to you to kick us off.
Okay, perfect. I'll go ahead and start with the first case. What we thought we would talk about today is sort of how we're applying current results, mostly data that came out during ASCO 2020. And then some other things that we may pepper into our conversation, to treating real cancer patients in the clinic, and particularly in light of some of the different kinds of risk-benefit conversations that have come up with COVID-19, at the forefront of our minds. So we'll just launch right into the first case. This is a 56-year-old woman who presents to your clinic to discuss neoadjuvant chemotherapy. She self-palpated a mass. She was found to have a 3.4-centimeter, ER90% 3+, PR70% 3+, HER2 3+ on IHC, invasive ductal carcinoma, with a Ki-67 that was high at 42%. She had one lymph node that looked abnormal on ultrasound. It was biopsied, and it was also found to contain metastatic cancer. She had a PET scan that was negative for distant metastatic disease. She's generally healthy but obese, with a BMI of 31, has no family history of cancer, but a strong history of coronary artery disease on her mother's side.
So with that foundation, what would your initial recommendation be for neoadjuvant chemo?
Yeah, I think this is a lady that is relatively young. She has an over 3-centimeter cancer that's node positives and HER2 positive, so certainly falls in the high risk category. So I think the standard approach for her would be TCHP or AC to THP. And, this really brings up a good point about the use of anthracyclines in early HER2 positive breast cancer. I think, I've always been in the camp that anthracyclines make me a little bit nervous, just because I know that these women get the most risk reduction out of their HER2 backbone, such as trastuzumab, and now also our pertuzumab. And so it really worries me to potentially hurt the heart and not be able to give that full year of the HER2 antibodies. So, we recently saw the data from TRAIN-2. And although this was a study that wasn't based in the U.S., so the regimens were a little bit different than what we're used to looking at, the 3-year disease-free survival with or without anthracycline was incredibly similar in this study. It was 92.7% versus 93.6. And the overall survival was over 97% in both patients who, the group that received the anthracycline and the group that didn't. So this really just gave me a little bit of fuel that maybe I think I'm doing it right in sparing these women anthracyclines, and really that the outcomes now with dual HER2 antibodies are so good that what are we really adding by adding anthracyclines? Dr. Mizell, what do you think about this?
Yeah, no, I agree with you completely. I definitely have been more of the mindset, even before this TRAIN-2 data came out, of using TCHP over ACTHP for most women. I think the other thing I would add to that is that I feel like the other interesting piece of this is that not all HER2 positive patients necessarily are created equal. I think there's kind of a continuum, as I see it, almost, of HER2 positivity. So for this woman who's strongly HER2 positive on IHC, especially now with the TRAIN-2 data, and in this case with the significant family history of coronary artery disease, I would definitely err away from the anthracycline. I think there are those occasional patients who come along that are HER2 equivocal on immunohistochemistry and kind of just over the border for positivity on FISH, but who are high grade and maybe ER/PR negative, who you think that maybe they're behaving a little bit more like triple negative than HER2 positive. And right, those women, if they're young and don't have a lot of cardiac risk factors, that might be the one situation where I would still think about doing an AC-THP kind of approach, thinking that maybe they would benefit from the anthracycline. But I think in general, I would err more towards TCHP in this situation. That would be probably what I would start with here.
And has your choice of chemotherapy altered much with COVID-19 in the curative setting, or has that maybe just influenced your choices more in the metastatic setting where ordering and things like that is a little bit more of a choice?
You know, I think it has influenced me more subtly. I think it's made me think a lot about, you know, who really needs the dual chemo, the TCHP. You know, I've had a few patients who've come through, and it's been more coincidental, but who have been strongly HER2 positive, but also a little bit more frail. You know, HIV as a comorbidity, renal insufficiency as a comorbidity, other things like that. And, you know, I've kind of said to those patients, I think you'll probably have a great response with THP, actually. And so in light of COVID, actually have started with THP in several of these instances in the last 2 months. There's the COMPASS trial that's coming out now in ECOG Akron and has been opened, looking at THP as a neoadjuvant regimen. And then if people get a PCR to THP, they get randomized in one direction. If they don't, getting randomized to another direction. There have been other studies also looking at THP. And I think, you know, the consensus is that those are probably the three most active drugs in that four-drug regimen. So I have done that for some patients. And then, you know, for those who are node negative, you know, a tumor bordering closer to 2 centimeters have definitely been more inclined to go with the Taxol Herceptin approach adjuvantly. Just the idea that less may be more now that we have this additional risk with COVID-19 to calculate into the risk-benefit conversation. I don't know, how have you been approaching this?
Yeah, similar. You know, I think you bring a good point for those maybe lower risk HER2 positive patients or those patients that are a lot older. I think as far as chemo choice, it's probably made a little bit less difference for me in the HER2 arena, but maybe a little bit more difference for me ER positive, particularly interpreting things like Oncotype, Mammoprint, and people that are kind of on the edge of needing chemotherapy or not. And sometimes that comes into our decision making.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I think with ER positives, and we'll have an ER positive case that we'll talk about a little later on in this session. I think in these areas where there's so much gray, it kind of allows you to take a step back and look at what, you know, what's really important and what each patient's risks and benefits are going to be. I think patients too are definitely, I think for those who used to come into the office, you know, just wanting to do everything they could to kill their cancer, almost to the exclusion of everything else. Now we're seeing a little bit more of the opposite. Not necessarily that people don't want to treat their cancer, but they also really are very scared of COVID and want to make sure they're
right.
At risk.
Absolutely.
I think the discussions are just a little more nuanced now, for sure.
And do you think in the future there will be any opportunities to de-escalate neoadjuvant chemotherapy further in patients with node-positive disease but have limited disease burden? And were any studies presented at ASCO or any upcoming trials? I know you mentioned the COMPASS trial that may shed light on this.
Yeah, so I think the COMPASS trial is really exciting. I'm looking forward to seeing what that looks like for women. The idea of looking at THP as an option for potential de-escalation for many of these patients who have HER2-positive and node-positive disease, because up until this point, you know, for those node-positive patients, really the standards of care, as Erica said, have been ACTHP or TCHP in the neoadjuvant setting, and anything less has kind of felt like, you know, maybe not enough. There were some interesting trials presented at ASCO this year also. There was a trial that looked at two different neoadjuvant de-escalation treatments, one looking at THP, and then another one looking at endocrine therapy plus trastuzumab and pertuzumab. The endocrine therapy, I think, was a little bit less ready for prime time. There was about a 24% PCR rate in those patients that were HER2 positive and hormone receptor positive. The patients who got 12 weeks of THP actually had a 57% PCR rate in this one trial, with the efficacy the highest in those patients who had 3+ HER2 positivity on immunohistochemistry. So I think still some research to be done, but I think there are definitely opportunities to de-escalate. And then potentially some opportunities to use imaging to help with de-escalation early on. So there was a trial looking at PET scan to identify patients with HER2-positive breast cancer, likely to benefit from even a chemo-free dual HER2 blockade with Herceptin or trastuzumab and pertuzumab. But I think, you know, that trial, which was, you know, I think, again, not something that's ready to do as standard of care, just highlights the idea that potentially we could use imaging and clinical response early on to kind of say, you know, are there patients in whom we can de-escalate? So I think the story on this is certainly not at its end. We're going to see more from this for sure. The patient that we were talking about earlier on, again, this is one with a node positive HER2/3+ ER/PR positive breast cancer. She initiates therapy with TCHP, as we said, you know, we would do. She gets 4 cycles of TCHP and then has 2 cycles of THP. The carboplatin was dropped for the last 2 cycles due to cytopenias and nausea. And then at surgery, she has 3 millimeters of disease left in one node with evidence of treatment effect and a 1.2 centimeter tumor bed with 30% cellularity. The residual disease is ER 80%, PR 70%, HER2 3+, once again, with a Ki-67 of 28%. And Erica, I wanted to just get your take on what your approach would be for this patient.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is where I definitely was a very early and quick adopter of the Catherine data. So, you know, again, Catherine was really for patients with HER2 positive disease that did not receive a pathologic complete response to whatever therapy they got in the neoadjuvant setting. And so I think what's really interesting about that is it's really agnostic to whether you got AC to THP, whether you got TCHP, whether you got Taxol, you know, with Herceptin and Perjeta. But, you know, in that trial, they showed an 11% improvement of disease-free survival. So really a huge magnitude of benefit compared to what we've seen in a lot of these earlier adjuvant trials. You know, we saw an updated abstract about the biomarker data from Catherine this year, and it really showed that all subsets benefit. Whether patients were high PD-L1, low PD-L1, whether they were PI3 positive or not, whether they have high or low HER2, all of these patients received benefit of adjuvant T-DM1. So for a woman like this, you know, particularly, she still has, you know, over a centimeter of cancer left in the breast. She still has disease in a lymph node. This is a patient that would benefit from adjuvant T-DM1. And so I would definitely be thinking about offering that to her.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. And I think the other nice thing about this is that you can always de-escalate if you have to. You know, a lot of patients, I think the challenge with T-DM1 is that it's definitely a little bit more involved from a, you know, from a physician standpoint, but from a patient standpoint in terms of side effects than doing trastuzumab and pertuzumab or just trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting. But, you know, if patients really don't tolerate it or don't feel as if they have the threshold to tolerate it, once they start it, you can always pull back and transition over to trastuzumab and pertuzumab or just trastuzumab.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people are talking about that. You know, that was kind of the criticism is that, you know, a full year of T-DM1 can be a little tough to get through. You know, I wonder what it would look like if it was 6 or 8 cycles of T-DM1 followed, you know, out. I think it's important to note in this woman's case that she's also ERPR positive. So she's going to be somebody that's going to be getting endocrine therapy to help with her risk reduction as well. So certainly, you know, endocrine therapy will play into this. I think it's important to note too, this was actually in a footnote of the Catherine study, that women did receive their endocrine therapy as well as radiation concurrent with the T-DM1. That's a question I get from a lot of people. And so certainly, you know, we can continue her other standard of care things like radiation and the initiation of her endocrine therapy while she does the T-DM1.
Right. And I think with these women, you know, there's also the opportunity, as you kind of alluded to with the idea of Lupron, that, you know, you can sort of step up the endocrine therapy for these patients too. So, you know, you could do the T-DM1 and then for a premenopausal patient, Lupron plus Tamoxifen or Lupron plus an AI. And then, you know, the question of how long you continue the endocrine therapy also has to do with how well they tolerate it. And I think, you know, the idea that there are all these different options, you know, the most aggressive to the least aggressive, and a lot of it depends on, you know, kind of what patients can tolerate and what some of their other side effects and comorbidities are. So it's always a discussion. But absolutely, I think that probably the T-DM1 would be the first pass. And then if they can't tolerate it or won't tolerate it, then moving on and making sure that they know they have other options. You know, happily, the T-DM1, very few of the side effects are going to be irreversible. So starting it doesn't usually, you know, come with any long-term cost.
Great. So I'll start us off on the second case. This is a 62-year-old, healthy, active female, and she comes to our clinic with a grade 1 invasive ductal carcinoma that is 2.0 centimeters. The cancer is ER 100% strong positive, PR 90%, and HER2 non-amplified with a Ki-67 of 14%. One lymph node does appear clinically abnormal, and it is biopsied and is positive for cancer. So how do we approach this case?
Yeah, this is a tough case. I think this is such a real world case because we see things like this all the time where it's not totally cut and dry what you do for these patients. I mean, I think, you know, some people would take these patients to surgery up front. Others would say, hey, she's got an involved lymph node, neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Others would say, hey, this is grade 1, strongly ER positive. How about neoadjuvant endocrine therapy? Some would order Oncotype and some would order Mammoprint. And I think, you know, particularly with COVID-19, you know, we sort of saw in the first few months of this, and I think we're probably going to see again as things continue to pick up, certainly in the Southeast, that people are not that excited about doing chemo for a grade 1 ER positive cancer unless they know that they really have to. And then people may not necessarily want to go to surgery right away if you're in an area where the hospital is full of COVID-19 patients and you're putting yourself at risk for possibly having to stay there. So we were seeing and are continuing to see more neoadjuvant endocrine therapy in these situations, actually, more neoadjuvant oncotypes being done. So I think this is an area that's being studied now, I think, in greater depth, and we're going to start to understand more about these patients. You know, we already have some data in terms of using MammaPrint for these patients, not necessarily neoadjuvantly, but adjuvantly. I think we're going to be gathering more data as time goes on about using Oncotype here, too, to see whether or not you can use that information to help guide your treatment plan going forward. So I think, you know, this patient, you know, it would be a definite discussion, and I've had these discussions in clinic over the last 3 months, I imagine, Erica, you have as well, about what all the options are and, you know, how we can approach this. I've had several patients that look a lot like this who have been hesitant about neoadjuvant chemotherapy and about upfront surgery. We've actually sent Oncotypes neoadjuvantly, understanding with them that there's not tons of data to support this in this space. But if they have had a low Oncotype test, which many of these women with ER 100% grade 1 tumors do, that we start neoadjuvant endocrine therapy and see how they do. So it'll be interesting to see what this looks like as time goes on and as COVID continues to proceed forward. But I think in this situation, I think there's not one right answer. It would be all about kind of presenting these options, like really talking the patient through what the options are and seeing where they settle in terms of how they feel most comfortable.
Yeah, is there a group or clinical characteristics that you feel less comfortable with the neoadjuvant endocrine therapy in than others? What would it take for this case to be different for you to kind of say, I don't know that neoadjuvant endocrine therapy is the best choice here?
So a few things, and I've had some of these women in my clinic as well recently where I've had to explain why I don't want to do that. you know, if it's grade one disease, I feel more comfortable. Yeah. Once we get to grade two or grade three with higher Ki-67s and maybe less uniform ER positivity, I feel less good about it. If you have any extranodal extension or more than one node, I feel less good about it. You know, those kinds of features. And also for younger women, I think, you know, premenopausal patients worry me just a little bit more across the board. So for me, the key in this case is that she's 62, it's grade one, it's strongly ER positive. Seems like there's only one node involved here. That would be a situation where I would feel comfortable, particularly if there were a neoadjuvant Oncotype score available. But even if not, I think I would feel okay with that here as long as the patient were okay with taking that risk. But yeah, I think those are sort of the main things for me. How about you?
Yeah, I agree. You know, yeah. The thing that was, you know, standing out to me on this case was that she was grade one and that ER was 100% and PR was 90%. I particularly worry when you see the PR loss, ER positive and PR negative. You know, normally those are the ones that end up, you know, high on Oncotype, or the ones that you just aren't as confident that they're truly driven on the endocrine axis. And so those are the ones that I shy away from, just like you do. So continuing this case, the patient goes to surgery first, and a pathology report shows a 1.9 centimeter grade 1 invasive ductal carcinoma with a 5 millimeter metastasis to one lymph node. Four additional sentinel lymph nodes are removed that are negative. An Oncotype is sent that returns with a score of 20. What would you recommend for systemic therapy? We're in a little bit of a data-free zone for positive lymph nodes and how to interpret Oncotype, et cetera. You know, Taylor X really liberalized who we can spare chemotherapy for now. But, you know, it didn't include the lymph node positive patients. You know, I think we're all really awaiting the data that'll help us answer that question. I tend to still kind of follow, you know, the genetics and biology over the pathology, at least for one positive lymph node. I think this is a situation where I would shy away if it was three positive lymph nodes. But, you know, this is a lady in her 60s that's, you know, low grade, strongly ERPR positive. And if it wasn't for that node with a score of 20, we wouldn't even be thinking twice about chemotherapy. We'd feel very comfortable with endocrine therapy. So this is a patient that I would discuss that of, you know, what is the absolute benefit of chemotherapy here over endocrine therapy? And does that make sense? Where do we want to go from here?
No, I agree with you. I think it's very tough. These are patients, and I find often these patients have their own opinions too about what they want to do. The hard thing with Taylor X, as you said, is that but for this 5 millimeter metastasis, we would not be doing anything. And she's had additional nodes removed that are negative. So I think, you know, presuming she has normal scans, you can pretty much trust that this is a patient who doesn't have, you know, any additional disease, at least any additional disease that you could see. And some people would say you may not even need to do staging scans on her. So I agree. I think this would be someone who I would feel comfortable doing endocrine therapy alone. I definitely have had a lot of these patients who themselves don't feel comfortable without doing some chemotherapy because there are some people out there who say that they should. And some of these people are seeking multiple opinions too. And I think if you ask five or six different oncologists, probably at least someone would say you should do chemo. And then it's hard for patients to rest having not done that chemo. I have patients in this setting recently where I have talked to them about doing endocrine therapy alone, and they've actually, you know, really felt like they couldn't sleep at night if we didn't do some chemo. And so I've ended up doing 4 cycles of TC for them and getting them through that, and then doing the endocrine therapy. But I don't know that I would feel strongly about getting the patient through the TC, particularly during the COVID era where people are a little more likely to end up, you know, hospitalized or having complications if they get chemotherapy that can depress their immune systems and all the rest. So I look forward to the day where we have more data to discuss that with. You know, I think everyone's anxiously awaiting the RxPonder data, and that will be very exciting for these women. But it is, I think it's very tempting to extrapolate TAILORx and some of the other trials in this setting, just because, you know, it feels like we probably should be able to do that in patients who have this small of a burden of lymph node disease.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've been talking about Oncotype and TAILORx. We saw updated results from MINDACT at ASCO as well. And that really, you know, showed us in this particular abstract that, you know, clinical high risk, but genomic low risk, the genomic low risk kind of trumps. And so, you know, we can safely omit chemotherapy in those patients, you know, 95% disease-free survival at shorter follow-up. And then at this 8-year follow-up that they showed us at ASCO, the disease-free survival was really quite good. Overall survival was 95% either way, whether people receive chemotherapy or not. And so I think, you know, it's just showing us that we're getting a little bit smaller, you know, smarter. You know, we used to kind of put all of our eggs in the basket of how big was the tumor, where is the tumor, and then maybe something on the pathology report like Ki-67. We really do have some better tools in our arsenal now, you know, to not only worry about, you know, how far the cancer was able to get, you know, based on a screening mammogram, but biologically, is this a nasty cancer or is this kind of a dumb cancer that's going to behave the way we want it to? And you know, I mean, I think that's good news for patients because I think we are able to spare more people chemotherapy and the side effects.
Yeah, no, I think it definitely can only be a benefit. And, you know, certainly with MammaPrint, I have patients who come to me with a MammaPrint test. Some patients who get an Oncotype that feels a little equivocal because of the node positivity and then ask for a MammaPrint test. And then sometimes I get, you know, discrepant information from one versus the other. Yeah, I've had patients who've had Oncotype scores less than 10 and they get a high-risk MammaPrint score. And it's hard to know what to do with those. I'd be curious as to your opinion. I feel like with my patients, I've often tended towards, you know, just going with the one that was more high-risk because patients have trouble getting a high-risk score on either end and then not pursuing chemo. But that's an area where I've struggled too, is sort of that, like, we have so many genomic tests in our arsenal, and what happens if the answers compete?
Yeah, I agree. I've seen the MammaPrint and Oncotype be discordant in both directions, right? So one's low and the other's high in both. And, you know, that's one of those things that you kind of want to curse the person that ordered the second one, because I personally won't order the second one. I'm like, we're going to order one and we're going to go with it because, you know, they don't always line up. But I agree with you, you know, if we really were just trying to gather information to make us feel good about safely omitting chemotherapy. But, you know, if there are things stacking up against that, a high risk on one, the fact that they're node positive, that there's PR loss, the patient's younger as opposed to older, I think kind of all of those things point us towards chemotherapy. You know, we certainly don't want to overtreat people, but we also don't want to undertreat somebody that's going to be, you know, ends up with metastatic disease that wasn't necessary either. So it's a fine line.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting. I think it is, we're fortunate to have so many different tools in our arsenal and to have so many, you know, really well-designed and good clinical trials to sort of back up our rationale for doing things. I find sometimes these discussions are the most difficult discussions. You know, it's in some ways easier when you've got a triple negative patient and you know needs Stosten's ACT and you can just talk to them about what that looks like and then move forward from there. These more nuanced situations, you know, with HER2 positive disease now, and then certainly with these ER positive, low nodal burden patients, you know, you want to make sure that you're doing everything you can, but you also don't want to do any harm. So we've got a lot of interesting territory to walk through, and I think that patient-doctor joint decision-making is never more important than it is now in this current climate that we're in. So it'll be interesting to see how everything continues to evolve as we continue to evolve in our cancer treatments along with COVID.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to Onc Live On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and institutional perspectives on cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of Onc Live On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Onc Live On Air.